The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast.
Boktang Gomolori is a clinical social worker and therapist with a Lacanian bent, living in New York City. And he was on the opposite side of a Zero Books panel debate at this year's Left Forum. In this episode, we almost discuss Avital Rennell, postmodernism, and Lacan. It's Wednesday, August 20th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. We started a Zero Books reading group for our patrons. It runs $15 a month on Patreon, and the first book on our list is Alzom Jappe's The Writing on the Wall. Support us on Patreon and join in reading Jappe's book to participate in our online discussion. All of our supporters get access to the Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives podcasts, and patrons who donate $5 a month or more get access to the Inside Zero Books podcast as well, which means they get access to a second podcast every week. Patreon supporters are helping us to continue our YouTube channel and our other online projects, like the online Capital Reading Group, which is scheduled for this coming Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific. The music you're listening to right now is a cover of The Average White Band's instrumental hit, Pick Up the Pieces, by Marty Q. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Boktang and I not quite discuss the deconstruction of Avital Rennell. So this Avital Rennell case is in the news. She's been fired from her position.
Well, she was only suspended for a year, as I understand
it. Okay, she's suspended from NYU for a year because of allegations of sexual harassment of a student that she was the advisor for this student. It has created a small furor in the academic world for a couple of reasons. One is just that she's a prominent deconstructionist philosopher, but the other reason is because so many feminists of that ilk, so many Derridean feminists came to her defense in a way that some people thought was hypocritical after the allegations. What I want to ask you isn't whether or not you think those people were hypocritical or not, we can get to that, but whether or not you think this Derridean deconstructionist position might lead to hypocrisy generally, or might have ethical or moral consequences in action, and whether or not this is actually symptomatic of the theory as much as it is of the person. Another way to put this is, like, Althusser killed his wife. To what extent did that act reflect upon his philosophy?
Uh-huh.
So the ball's in your court.
All right. Well, that's a pretty potent question. First, I wanted to start from saying something that I don't think is discussed much, that the whole idea of ontology, to my understanding, originates in 17th seminar of Lacan, where he speaks about discourses. In particular, he connects it to the question of shame, right? So, honte, shame is in French sounds ontology, right? So he connects these two words and creates kind of a neologism with a new meaning. This helps him to speak how, for example, falling into the discourse of university with its shame and dominance is maybe something that mankind doesn't really need. And that's 69 or 1970. So fast forward to 90s, after the collapse of Soviet Union, Derrida writes this book on Specters of Marx and tries to talk of ontology in a way that is different, I find, and which is, as I understood from his book, this thing that we do need some form of ghost, we do need some form of shame to remain messianic and almost religious way, violent cancellation of any form of metaphysic, and first and foremost, applying the constructionist method to this ghost.
When it comes to shame, Lacan created this idea of ontology to refer to shame. How is it that shame can fill in the gap between the present as we experience it and the world as it is outside of our senses? Or to put it a different way, how is it that shame is ontological? How does shame fill in this place where we might think of the material world as existing? Tell me if I'm reaching here, but the connection is to ontology is through authority. When you refer to something metaphysical or ontological, you're referring to something that is, not to use the Lacanian phrase inadvertently, but that is real. If you can get in touch with what is ontological, then you can know what really, truly is, and that knowledge can then be the justification for your actions, whether they're political or social or personal. Having reference to the ontological truth would give you a support in your activity beyond what we think of as subjective support. It wouldn't just be your own activity that you would have to justify yourself. It would be justified by knowledge of the truth of the world.
Correct, yeah. But Lacan exactly problematizes this discourse, calls it discourse of university or knowledge, and it says that this discourse does establish itself as a social link, but it really avoids the material by trying to valorize this materiality through set of scientific categories that, you know, are pretty much absolute. But the funny thing is that, of course, for example, deconstructionism is rallying against absolutes, but that's problematic.
So shame would be this feeling of not getting in touch with the truth, right? Shame would be a recognition of your own lack, your own inability to touch ground and justify yourself ontologically. And you would feel shame because of that failure.
Yeah, so it's really this shame of failure and to find one's place in relation to this big other. And of course, Lacan's point is very much, and he further develops it in 70s, that we are in the time of discourse of shame. Now that we have canceled ideology, everything is ideological. I think that's also an argument that Zizek uses, also to kind of address exactly this cynicism that supposedly has completely canceled all the points of judgment and demonstrate that it still forms some kind of, you know, point of authority and absolute authority. For Lacan, to deal with absolute authority, one has to take a step farther beyond this kind of veil of big others, shaming ghosts that can be seen in this spectrum, a spectrum of specters, and deal with unary trade of gaze, point, in our reality that is structurally the point from which we see ourselves. So it's really the point of self-reflection that cannot be reduced to its multiplicity of big others components, and deal with this directly, or try to deal with this object of the unconscious directly. Of course, that's an impossibility because unconscious is barred from us. But, you know, recognizing this incompletion of our unconscious and engaging in this with this unconscious as this incomplete, with the shame as itself incomplete theory that needs to be worked on, it is different from deconstructionist approach to this specter of ghosts, which is to kind of line them up and then call out the good ones and then shoot the rest.
I still am not quite clear about the spectral quality of shame. I think I have a beginning an understanding of that, but let's see if we can work it out a little bit. So you notice, you're a philosopher of some kind or another, or a psychoanalyst, and you notice that when you try to ontologically ground your activities, that you can't. That you are all stuck in a subjective position, and that the reality of your situation is always out of reach. This is what it means for the unconscious to be barred from you as well, I think. That is, not only is the world outside of your perception out of reach, but even your own materiality and your own motivations and your own activity isn't transparent to you. That you come along after you're already in motion, say. So then this puts the justifications you might use for your own activity into doubt. And you feel ashamed of your activity and of your doubt maybe about your own justifications. But that shame has a material quality to it. It's something that, is kind of beyond your consciousness. It's not something that that has an objective character to it. Is that right?
It has a structural character to it. I think that despite all the subjectivism of post-structuralism, there is an attempt to, in this atomistic way, to find some objectivity and clarity in dealings with this symbolic structure. And really what ends up happening is that Big Other is perceived as a complete being, and I think, you know, it's attempted to kind of deal with the multiplicity of it and call the centrality of that gaze within that Big Other, and the centrality of dialectic in this Big Other as something that is absolute, that's a thing of the past, that's a thing of metaphysics. And in a way, it is negativity. In a way, it can be also, you know, over-concentration on difference and how all signifiers are, you know, different, and something gets lost. Supposedly this unity, this unary trait is something that needs to be discarded, but really you have to deal with the totality of your judgment and where you position yourself in regards to it. Derrida comes very critical against Lacan's and Marx's positionalism, what he calls it. Again, in this post-structuralist universe, it's very difficult to take any positions because there is no center, there is no even centralized void.
It's the lack of structure, not the lack of materiality, that
distinguishes Lacan from Derrida?
Well, I would say lack of recognition that there is constant misrecognition as of structure as being complete, and that being within the very dialectic of the structure, and that it cannot be just called the evil father and overcome, because it is this empty signifier that is part of who we dialectically are. And also our ethical decisions need to be based on what we perceive at the end of the day as some form of totality.
Right. So we imagine a subject of knowledge, that we imagine a version of ourselves maybe that could in fact reach the real world, that would have true knowledge, that would have a justified power. And this becomes a name of the father, say. I'm not sure if I'm using the Lacan right, but this becomes an object of our fantasies as well. The deconstructionist position would be to point out that that figure doesn't really have any access to knowledge, is ideological and insubstantial, and is just another subjectivity. Whereas the Lacanian position would be that fantasy, while not actually complete, in other words, not truly justified, as a figure, is necessary. Nonetheless, that it is what it signifies isn't so much positive understanding, but the fact of our disconnection from the world.
Of course, and if approached from the place of dialectic and how this unity of opposites is some form of unity, and not approached from, for example, retrograde position of patriarchal absolute power that is constantly equated with materialist theories these days.
And this is why, like, animal consciousness is so attractive to some postmodern types or post-structuralists, is because it's a kind of consciousness that can be imagined not to have that masculine subjective component, that can be justified without being disconnected, that is sort of blameless at the same time.
Right, but the paradox here is that animals do see these shapes and complete forms in their process of evolution. This has played a fundamental role, as Lacan shows it, and actually Lacan makes animalism and our imaginary that stems from our evolution as one of the three cornerstones of his theory. Supposedly, Derrida rejects this imaginary, wholeness, and deals with the symbolic and how it can be traced. But I think you're right. Derrida, Deleuze, they end up in a completely imaginary, universe. Paradoxically, exactly by the way of renouncing this imaginary wholeness, and everything becomes ideological.
Right, everything becomes ideological, which means that there's no limit. They're actually, they become, even though they're trying to strike a blow against positivity, their own subjectivity becomes unmoored or, unlimited. And basically, whatever they can dream up doesn't need justification, because nothing can be justified. I mean, I sound like Jordan Peterson here, but...
Have you ever met a truly mature person? Seriously. Have you? And what would that be? What would that look like? This is something that I think we are world historically pressured now to consider, particularly since Kant urged upon us the recognition and realization that one likes to choose immaturity. We get off on it. We like to stay there. We love our tethers. Of course, one has to break up the we here. For Goethe, my main man Goethe, immaturity was a good thing. He had what he called wiederholte Pubertät, so recurrent puberty, which, you know, at the age of over 70, he fell in love with a 17-year-old, and it kept him going, it kept him writing. So there's perhaps, if you switch on the transvaluating machine, there's a good immaturity and there's a bad immaturity.
I'd really leave that first thing that you started with unanswered about Alpha Sir. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, 70s and now we're kind of dealing with, or 90s and 70s, we're dealing with kind of two different collapses. 70s was dealing with collapse of 1968. 90s was dealing with the collapse of Soviet Union. One could say that, you know, one of the manifestations of this crisis in 70s was also, but again, this is, just my speculation and in no way justification of, anything, that this was maybe what spiraled Althusser out of control, and or maybe he was in control and that's how he was gaining control through patriarchal domination over his spouse's body. And I think that this another crisis that we're dealing with right now is Trump's presidency. And I was thinking, you know, about this you know, discourse of hysteric as this kind of revolutionary discourse, and then discourse of Trump, which has been very much this hysteric revolutionary, hystericizing himself against, in a populistic way, media against establishment media itself and such and such. And, you know, what crisis does this put, for example, the line of thought that bases its purity on the idea of firmly remaining within the hysterics discourse? You know, when we say that, I think in Adorno and Horkheimer, this is developed, that fascists themselves were led by this discourse of victimhood and what it entails. You know, I think that now with this reappearance of you know, very strong right-wing populist currents, we're seeing again this discourse of victimhood really benefiting right more than the left almost.
Why is the right able to claim victimhood without appearing hysterical and weak?
It is appearing as hysterical and weak, but that's its power, and that's the most powerful position you can really take in life, you know, almost. And it's funny that, like, deconstructionists were presenting, and critical theorists were always presenting this position as being this kind of castrated, egalitarian point of no kind of violence, you know, or no problem.
I don't think that Trump wants to feel or wants to feel weak nor appear to be weak. And when you look at the rhetoric coming out of, say, the Proud Boys or the online anti-social justice warrior clique, they're much more on the side of, like, the university discourse and a feeling of being empowered rather than being weak. But they do rely on putting themselves in the victim's position in order to justify that, their own claims to be normal, say, or they have to have the villain of the social justice warrior, for instance, who's going too far and is too far to the left in order to justify their own reactionary politics.
Yeah, I mean, what they're doing is displaying this unity of opposites of them being victims and victors at the same time in a more vivid way. My accusation towards post-structuralist and vitalist currents is that they're not recognizing how this dialectic of exactly, subjectivity within the structure works, that you will produce the excess. There will be some form of act or acting out that you will have to take ethical responsibility for. And that is foreclosed on all levels in this postmodern theory that we're talking about. Underneath it, it is this desire to stay clear of losing power and actually keep gaining power. And, you know, this writerly internationale that Eagleton is jokingly accusing Derrida of trying to form, that has no party, no flag, no nothing. And that there is this fantasy that Derrida very clearly displays in Spectres of Marx, that there can be some kind of this moral international community that can rise. It's really funny because Althusser wrote,
the community that's not a community, a subject that's not subjective.
Right, exactly. That has no responsibility for its place of power or position in regards to structure of production as such. And the structure of production is very important, even in the field of knowledge production and the field of theory, and actually it's very related to it. We're kind of not mentioning.
Yeah, I want to get to it, to Rennell here. I mean, I want you to, I mean, look, it seems to me that once, now that we've described the postmodern or post-structuralist position as ultimately vitalistic and irresponsible, it seems natural to believe that someone who espouses that ideology or that philosophy could act in ways that are vitalistic and irresponsible, as she's been accused of doing.
Yeah, then, earlier you mentioned that there were a lot of also feminist authors. I haven't really looked at the list of people who have signed the letter in her support, but one of them was definitely Zizek, right? And
right, yeah, Zizek is one. Another is Judith Butler.
And Zizek is definitely not somebody who is in this deconstructionist camp and has been very critical of it in many ways, though I spoke about Hegelian humanism a bit earlier today, and I think that his Hegelianism lends him interesting bedfellows, though, you know, maybe without this Hegelianism, he would not have been where he's at, and without these bedfellows. More importantly, I want to emphasize how, again, this process of production has been really foreclosed by these discourses from us, even within academia, you know, and so, it, you know, I would want, you know, probably at least Zizek to be more oriented towards analyzing social links like he was doing it in the 90s, because, you know, I understand he's an intellectual who is really producing books, and he decided not to ground himself in any one institution, really. But in a certain way, you know, this is also a kind of gift to this discourse of, you know, unaccountability, and just how this knowledge is being produced, and how we live in this contract freelancer economy and such. But even within this economy and with this claim of academia that it's nothing but a victim and especially humanities, we still have to, I think, again, not be too humanist here, but deal with the structure and the problem with the structure of their theory and what is ignored in this, exactly production of surplus knowledge, production of power relations within the social link that I believe. And, you know, I've spoken with you, once already this year on podcast, and then we had a panel, and in both cases I emphasized exactly that we need to deal with production in social links on all levels at this point in history. And I just wish that these signatories would have been the ones who would have spoken exactly like right now. This is a sign for us to look at how, you know, the left has really very internal problem of, you know, not having applied material analysis of what it's doing, even in its exiled intellectual field. You know, I really think this is the place to start. Like, this is the call, I think, a good time for a call for, you know, dealing with materiality of ethics on all interpersonal discursive levels, you know.
So, to put that into concrete terms, do you mean that the left needs to address its own nepotism and inequality?
Well, not address. It's a constant process. I think that it needs to adopt a discourse of responsibility for every position that anybody ever takes, you know, and without this kind of blank spaces that basically allow for then, you know, absolute powers and such. You know, but that's not really, you know, that's a symptom.
So this would be another way of saying there'd be some discipline.
I mean, it does require, I think, collective recognition of limitations of the big other and you know, how one has to really kind of step in and structure something if they don't want it to be structured by what already exists, so to say. So, yeah, in a way, this is sometimes perceived as a discipline, but, you know, it's really just something that occurs as an alternative and parallel to existing structures that have plenty of discipline. And we're very disciplined people, and Americans are one of the highest disciplined people in the world, according to work ethic and such. I don't know. There was some research on that. And, you know,
Well, here's what I would say to that is that if we are going to do what you're asking, which is come up with our own structures of understanding and organization and our own sort of left standards, what we can't do is let the already existing institutional standards, say, in the university, make up our minds for us about somebody like Avital Ronell. Like, the question for me is still an open one as to whether or not she acted inappropriately. Or, that's probably the wrong way to put it, because inappropriately, people can act inappropriately. Whether or not she violated, some set of rules around sexual harassment, or whether she assaulted this fellow, is still an open question. There's been some allegations, and how we understand those allegations, you know, can't be determined by the mechanism of Title IX, not if you're actually on the left. And from where I'm sitting, you have to have something like equitable due process, and you can't foreclose the possibility of self-defense the way that Title IX does.
I
would put her.
No, I definitely, you know, don't think that, you know, this is any time to celebrate, you know, kind of proper functioning of this machine, because I don't know if it functioned properly. I don't know if this was really something or more or less. I did read some also things that were presented as factual evidence. But,
well, like, just as an example, if she were to release the messages that he sent to her during these 3 years that they were engaged in this relationship that was apparently abusive, then she would be accused of violating his privacy and blaming the victim. And but the standard is that her messages to him can be released into the public and scrutinized in a one-sided way, as a, you know, as a bit of juicy gossip, and you know, can be made to seem as damning as possible out of context.
Yeah, I mean, this is already problematic that this needs to be, like, you know, or could be, you know, judged in a court of a public opinion, because, you know, there is supposedly an institutional process for that, which is already problematic. But again, if somebody buys into institution, to a certain extent, they buy into this, not only contractually, I think, but also, but of course, this also involves the process of whistleblowing, right? And so theoretically, you know, if, she has, you know, emails that proclaim his love for her or something like that, you know, blowing a whistle on how Title IX misfunctioned here by releasing them could, you know, be a position that she could take. I can see that happening. But
yeah,
you know, I think that this is, you know, what really got to me was that Haaretz article that was published actually in the spring that had somebody discussing kind of how things that everybody knows, you know, and that is more of the problem, you know, like when things like there is, you know, everybody knows when the letter in defense is not about like this didn't happen, but like, you know, she's a big figure and that also like implies and everybody knows, you know, and, you know, so, you know, that was a real red flag. So it really, I did discursive analysis here that, you know, does not require.
What did everyone know? What did the letters of defense give away that everyone already knew? I mean, basically, was it saying, yeah, we all already know that she.
Fundamentally, paradoxically, a defense of a patriarch. You know, everybody, he's a master. You know, I mean, in a way, after all these decades of cancellation of the master by, the constructionists, it's the only defense that comes to her support in this case, how great of a master she is. And exactly this mastery is this empty space in which then things are excluded out of, for example.
In other words, allowances are made for the king.
Right. Yeah. But the king is also naked, you know, but that, you know, that was right. A big discovery for post-structuralists, but that was really there in structuralism as well, without any doubt.
Mm. Right. I mean, if you've ever hung around with people who've been a part of a cult, one of the things that happens is that the guru inevitably takes advantage of his flock sexually. I mean, that happens a lot, and it's really interesting because usually these days in these kind of new age cults, the guru position is the position of the least amount of subjectivity, the most humble person. The enlightened person is the one who's gotten beyond desire, right? And who knows that their own identity is a fiction, say. That's the enlightened position.
I'm tired of being small. I've experienced things.
If you're tired of it, you're not finished with it yet. When you're tired of it, that feeds it. What you react against, what you don't like, you need more of. It works counterintuitively.
So what can I do to change that? What new behavior can I practice?
What you just did with your hand. Like this instead of.
That's it? You just keep doing that?
Filled with quiet warmth, yes. You, in the midst of anything, just opening and softening.
But when it comes to these usually completely justified allegations of sexual impropriety, I'm thinking of one Canadian mystical guru type that, you know, took a couple of teenage girls as his mistresses. The family looks the other way because, oh, well, he's enlightened. He's a master. So it's a very odd situation that the mastery comes at the moment of, you know, total negation of the self.
Yeah, yeah. I'm more thinking right now about Lacan, to be honest with you. I was kind of trying to research really quickly today and wasn't really able to find satisfying answer to whether Lacan was sleeping around with his students or and Analysants.
Those allegations are out there, right?
Yeah.
People said that.
I was looking at some articles. It was not really clear, like, for me that it's said. I have to look again. Maybe I didn't really want to find the specifics. But, you know, I mean, fundamentally also, he was not, of course, a professor anywhere. He did not hold institutional powers besides his own institution that then he dissolved. And, you know, of course, as an analyst, there is a power in the relationship, and I don't really know if there is confirmation that one of his analysants was his mistress. I mean, maybe everybody approached him as analyst, though, you know, he was not in analytic relationship with them. It's a question I have. But in terms of, you know, what we're dealing with late capitalism, and again, like, kind of collapse of this kind of multiplicity of authorities in the society called, fathers, and the family structures based on, this kind of more traditional forms. And, with that, we are seeing more consolidation of this authority power in, institutions and, also different social organizations and marginal groups, of course, especially this discourse of victimhood, right? Exactly, that becomes this kind of discourse of like faultlessness, through fire, kind of because of the suffering or something like that. You know, becomes this, again, excuse, right? And,
have you ever met Ronell? Just out of curiosity, have you ever spent any time with her? Did she touch you inappropriately?
No, Zizek was always there as a father to make sure that I would remain castrated. But no, seriously. Last time I saw her, I was able to spark a little argument between her and Zizek when she suddenly interrupted me and said that, oh, this is too cliche. And then Zizek returned to her and he was like, but cliches is what we need right now. It's time for cliches, you know? And I don't remember. I mean, it's on the NYU post.
Is that online? Cause I'd love to insert that.
if that part was towards the very end of the questions when I already was able to kind of this, you know, provoke it, the conversation.
what did you say that she said was a cliche?
You can hear from a conversation.
Okay. I'll look it up. But in any case, so, you felt that she kind of made this move to shut down the discussion.
Well, it was already towards the end of the lectures and question time, so she was in that position. But I think what came out as the result of this cliche, and you know what it represents, is just this unary trait. You know, that even if it's stupid, even if it's incomplete, we do have to take responsibilities for the links that are established, relationships. And political positions, you know. And
sorry? Absolutely.
Radical democracy.
What does it mean?
I don't know. Hegelian negativism criticizing everything, basically.
No! I'm extremely engaged concretely here and there. Radical democracy, if you ask, I'm not a fetishist of democracy. I can well imagine examples, even bourgeois ones. acceptable to people. Look, this is my usual provocation. Once I was with Finkelkraut in that stupid radio talk.
Now you're really going.
No, but I will very short. Sorry, this is interesting. And I told him, can you imagine a situation where you have a legitimate government, undoubtedly democratically elected, and then a tiny minority calls for fighting against this government and brutally starts killing it? He says no. I told him General de Gaulle. Every history of France tells you that first, this is the oppressed part. Pétain was, you know, when Germans were advancing to somewhere down there to Bordeaux or I don't know, to Toulouse, the French Assemblée Nationale withdrew there, and Pétain was legitimately in a formal democratic sense, of course, nominated the ruler of France, and undoubtedly, communists admitted this, somewhere till 42, if there were to be so-called free elections, Pétain would have probably won with 90%. What General de Gaulle did absolutely was not democratically legitimized. His idea was, no, we don't recognize this government and armed struggle. We start killing them and so on. I'm here on de Gaulle's side. So, you know, but even Ernesto Laclau is more ambiguous here. For some time, he was more for democracy in the sense of, you know, blah, blah. Then all of a sudden, through his, he had hopes that he will become what he later has become in Argentina, that is a state philosopher of Chavez, ne? And all of a sudden he started to talk about progressive potentials of military coup d'etat, no, and so on. You know what I mean? I'm radical democracy is for me, again, it doesn't tell enough. It's too empty a word for me.
Thank you very much for emptying out some of these cliches and let's and continue.
Ah, wait a minute.
No,
now
we're done.
Criticize you, yes.
We're done.
Here I protest against you. The best line of Sam Goldwyn is, you know, the legend when some studio, his studio was criticized by some journalists. There are too many old cliches in your movies. You know, he wrote a memo then to his scenario department. We urgently need new original cliches. It's deeply true because it's easy to be original with just originality. The true revolution is to introduce new cliches. Cliches are the stuff of everyday life. We need new cliches. And I'm afraid if you pursue this revisionist line, I wonder if there will be a place for you in this society of new cliches. Honestly.
Well, let's thank you very much.